I'm John Batchelor, Nuclear Weapons in Space. The Operation Starfish Prime, 1962. The U.S. of A exploded a nuclear weapon in orbit. That led to a catastrophe of all the satellites then in orbit, low Earth orbit. What is to be done? It is now more than 60 years later, and there may not be a solution, but there could be a way of determining what the risk is. David Livingston, Dr. Space, my colleague and co-host, this is episode N of Hotel Mars, and we're very pleased to be joined by Associate Professor Angela DiFulvio, writing most recently in Nature magazine about an experiment by a researcher named Denegulian that can't stop a nuclear weapon in low Earth orbit from creating a havoc with communications and intelligence and warfighting, but it can determine where and how those nuclear weapons have been deployed in the event of catastrophe. Angela, a very good day to you. The experiment in 1962 has led to questions about how do you read there's a nuclear weapon there? I understand there is a possibility of creating a satellite that is winningly called an inspector. In that inspector is the ability to read what? What is in the nuclear weapon that you can detect quite different from all the other radiation around low Earth orbit? Good evening to you.
Okay, good evening, John and David. Thank you very much for having me. It is a pleasure to join your show today. So the nuclear weapon itself contains fissile material that typically it is a secret combination of uranium and plutonium. And it is in a configuration such that it can be detonated at the time when it wants to be, when it's desired to be detonated by making it supercritical and thus explosive. Now, the fissile material itself, it is not extremely radioactive. So a detector itself placed next to a nuclear weapon passively, it would not be able to detect it with high sensitivity. But if another particle, high energy particle, for example, were to interact with this fissile material, then a number of products, including neutrons, are created. And this is precisely the process of induced fission, which is exploited in nuclear weapons themselves to sustain the chain reaction, as well as in nuclear reactors, for that matter, where it's well, very well controlled. But it's also the same principle that lets us detect it potentially in this scenario. So induced radiation from an external high energy proton in this particular case would be that signature unique to the content of a nuclear weapon that would make it detectable.
David, you have a question.
Yes, I'm curious, Angela, how would you test an inspector satellite to really know that it could detect it? Because in theory, you can't send one up there because there probably aren't any nuclear weapons yet, at least we hope, right? And you probably don't take it over to our stockpile of nuclear weapons and say, detect them. So how would you test it to know that it really works? Otherwise, it's theoretical, correct?
Correct. So this is a great question. There are two things at the very least that need to be tested. The one thing is, as I said, the sensitivity, and the sensitivity can be scaled to the mass of the weapon itself in a way, in other words, a fissile mass smaller than a weapon can be tested, and then the behavior of the system can be extrapolated to a larger mass. So let's say that we take a smaller uranium 235, or even potentially a plutonium 239, highly enriched material. And these could be obviously in smaller quantities than those that would be deployed in a weapon. But these could be then the source term the source that will be used for testing this particular detector setup. So this is the first test that should be made to make sure that the induced signature is detectable and with the planned sensitivity, then again extrapolated to a larger mass. The second test is a survivability test in a high radiation environment that would mimic as closely as possible the environment in space. And while we do not have exactly a field that reproduces this, it can be closely mimicked. For example, electron accelerators could be used to mimic the electron shower part, as well as high energy protons could be used to test the survivability of the high energy cosmic ray portion of the space radiation environment. Obviously, nothing resembles exactly the space environment, but these few tests would give enough confidence that the system then could be deployed in space.
Professor, there's radiation all around you. You're at the bottom of the Van Allen Belt. Everything is around you could be a weapon as far as radiation is concerned. So if I understand this very technical language, you have the risk of false positives because the weapon-induced spallation neutrons are difficult to read from the background radiation. How do you overcome that?
So this is an excellent point, and this is, in my opinion, the main challenge of this system. The false positives can be addressed in several ways. So there is a first approach that would discriminate radiation other than neutron-induced signal. For example, electrons, that could be high-energy electrons, but also electrons produced by gamma rays. And these have a different time behavior inside the detector that is proposed compared to neutron response. So in other words, if we look at each interaction that occurs in the detector from a neutron, this would look temporally different, considerably longer than an interaction generated by a gamma ray. And this is called pulse-shaped discrimination. So the pulse, the shape of a single pulse is inherently physically different for an electron compared to a neutron. So this is the first level of discrimination that can be done by virtue of the nature of the detector. The second level of discrimination can be done, and it also serves the purpose of locating the device. The proposed approach includes two panels at about 10 centimeter distance from each other, so relatively close. And the idea is that the first detector interacts with the a neutron interacts with the top panel, let's say the one closest to the satellite to be verified. And then it scatters off that first panel and is detected again by the second one. These two events occur within a few nanoseconds from each other, maybe even a shorter amount of time. And these two events are referred to events in coincidence. So if we set a very short time gate between two events occurring in the two panels, this allows us to further discriminate a neutron that interacted in that way. It's really helpful because the probability that an event in coincidence in such a short time frame would occur from the natural environment, even in the so harsh environment in space, then is further reduced. So these are the two ways that false positives can be mitigated. But let me just say one thing very clearly, that while this is very known and well working in the lab, when things get to space, then they become extremely more challenging. And that's that is the part that perhaps we'll talk about later.
David, you have a question.
Who would have an inspector satellites? Because it seems to me you're going to need oversight. So does that mean the United States has them to check on Russia and China, and Russia has them for China and the United States? So everyone has to have their own? Or do you see like a United Nations agency controlling inspector satellites to watch all of us? What's the oversight process?
Oh, I like that, David. The IAEA in space. very nice, David. Go ahead. Go ahead, Professor.
Yes, it is an excellent question, and it's a policy question more than a technical one. But if a safeguarding approach taken along the lines that the other treaties that exist, like the Non-Proliferation Treaty, then it would make sense that a third agency like the IAEA, as you just said, will be able to operate these inspectors.
Yes, Monsieur Signor Grossi in a commander suit, like a space cadet. Wonderful. Professor, one more detail here. This takes time, right? You estimate you're going to passively determine this over a week's time, 7 days. Is that correct?
These are the 7 days is a scenario, and it is a scenario where the distance between the object and the inspector is at the 4 kilometers. Again, this is a viable scenario that is selected by the study, thinking that it would not trigger any response.
Right. Right.
And so potentially getting closer could reduce further this time, but it may also take longer if, should that distance not be very precise and the inspector not be able to maintain it, which opens a more operational question of the inspector, because it requires a non-negligible power to keep the orbit at that precise distance, if that is ultimately what is needed to achieve the uncertainty in the count.
Professor Angelo De Fulvio of very carefully helping us to understand the initial steps towards detecting a nuclear weapon hiding in low Earth orbit. When we come back, what is to be done with an unlimited budget? What's next? David Livingston, I'm John Batchelor, Hotel Mars. This is Hotel Mars. I'm John Batch with my colleague and co-host and co-pilot, David Livingston, and we're very pleased to speak to Angelo De Fulvio, a professor of physics, who's helping us understand the proposal of a passive detection device to scout out bad acting in low Earth orbit, a nuclear weapon that can bring down or wreck all the other satellites around it, and maybe all satellites eventually. Because this happened once upon a time in 1962 in the ignorance of experiments of nuclear weapons in space. Professor, you see some areas that you can improve with your unlimited budget. We have a few minutes. Please explain.
Thank you, Dr. Batchelor. And so the areas for improvement, in my opinion, needs to be in the electronics and in ensuring that the false positive minimization is indeed doable in the harsh space environment. There are some pillars that this proposal is based on, and a very nice idea that one can exploit existing high energy protons to induce fission in fissile materials inside the nuclear weapon. And then detect them directionally. to not only detect the presence, but also precisely locate it in space. And this, as we were discussing earlier, assumes that advanced techniques, advanced detection and sensing techniques are still viable in space with the combination of proposed detectors and electronics. And I believe that more research is needed precisely in this area to increase and enhance the capabilities of organic scintillators in this particular case and silicon photomultipliers. These are the readouts of the detectors to ensure that these pulse-shaped discrimination can still be performed to keep the false positives as small as possible. Fulfill this mission and this objective.
David, you have a question.
Has what we've been talking about the same thing as what we also talk about as an EMP, which would affect us here on Earth, not just in space, or is this something only space related?
The effects would also be felt on Earth. So the EMP is another scenario where this could become relevant.
There's an anecdote from the Starfish Prime experiment in 1962. They actually sold tickets at Hawaiian hotels to dine on the rooftop so that you could witness the spectacular show in space in orbit, because I believe the detonation was over the Pacific. They saw it all right, and they were wowed, but they were also scared. And it was later that they realized how much damage this is the U.S. had done in experimenting with that weapon. So it only takes one of these weapons to go off. Everybody's going to know it, David. It's going to be pretty obvious. And we're then going to lose all communications that we depend upon, hardened or not. Is that correct, Professor? The hardened satellites, even that we can't be certain, wouldn't go down with that explosion.
That is correct, John. The Arden satellites certainly would be more resilient to this to the detonation, but the thing is that the products of the induced fission would remain in space for months and even years, and so we really cannot predict what the effects would be in the long term. And if we think that at the time when Starfish occurred, one third of the satellites were destroyed. If this were to happen today, it would be really a catastrophic event.
Well, it'd get Elon Musk's attention, that's for sure, because we're talking on Starlink right now, and I would have no way to talk to you. Now, one more detail about this theoretical explosion. To your knowledge, you're working on it, and Professor Dan Naguli is working on it. Is this also a NASA project, an ESA project? Do you know that?
I'm not aware of it, and possibly.
Possibly. Because it beg pardon, but it immediately has warfighting ramifications. You can see that. And I could see that a nuclear weapon in space would be extremely threatening. To know where it is would be helpful, but it wouldn't end the story. One more detail about your work on this right now. David asked the question, how do you test such a thing? Are you now able to test, to run a test experiment, or is that a secure question?
So the test experiments could potentially be run in a classified environment. Not at universities.
Yes, I didn't want to ask a classified question. I was trying to avoid that, but I thank you. We thank Professor Angela DeFulvia, the Department of Nuclear Plasma and Radiological Engineering, the Granger College of Engineering and the Program in Arms Control and Domestic and International Security, University of Illinois. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. This is a special edition of Hotel Mars. What can go wrong and why on Earth? Why we need a Mars colony just in case? I'm John Batchelor.